From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Values Voter Edition, day three of the 2020 virtual Values Voter Summit, America, Pray, Vote, Stand. And you can join us live this evening at 8 p.m. Eastern. Go to valuesvotersummit.org. All right, as we move closer to Saturday and President Trump's anticipated nomination to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham joined me last night to discuss the timeline and process of the confirmation hearing in just a moment. I'll be joined by one of the members of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, to discuss the significance of this nomination, his preferences among those being talked about, and something I talked about with Senator Graham last night, the anticipated attack on the nominee's religious faith. All right. More violence last night, this time in Louisville, Kentucky, after police officers were not indicted in the death of Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old woman fatally shot by Louisville police during a botched execution of a search warrant. Dr. Al Mohler joined us at the Values Voter Summit last night from Louisville. We'll hear from him. And back on the Supreme Court, how do we navigate fact from fiction and how the confirmation process is supposed to work, and the history of how it has worked? I'll share my conversation with Dave Hoppe from the Values Voter Summit. Dave has spent years in staff leadership positions on Capitol Hill, including chief of staff to former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. And speaking of Capitol Hill, I sat down in the Capitol with the author of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, Missouri Congresswoman Ann Wagner, and Republican Whip Steve Scalise, who has teamed up with Ann to ensure babies who survive abortion attempts are given life-saving medical care. But they're being blocked by members of the Democratic Party. We'll talk about that and the GOP's congressional agenda. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it is at T. Perkins. And let me remind you, big focus of the Values Voter Summit this year as we move into what I have said is one of the most consequential elections in the history of our republic, is to take the challenge. We're challenging the values voters, conservatives out there across the country, to take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. And you can take the challenge. Our goal, 1 million. 1 million conservative voters who will take the challenge. Text the word VOTE, that's V-O-T-E, to 53445. That's 53445. And you'll take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. All right, as I said, President Trump has said he will announce his nominee on Saturday to fill the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court created by the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Last night, Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, spoke at the Values Voter Summit and had this to say about the pending confirmation process.
I am ready to play it any way they want to play it. I'm praying that we have a challenging hearing for the nominee, but it's not embarrassing to the country and the Senate. People of faith, your faith may be subject to a lot of questioning. It's okay to be a religious conservative. It's okay to be on the Supreme Court if you're a religious conservative. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure the person nominated will apply the law to the facts and put their personal beliefs aside, but we're not going to tolerate a country where you're punished for your faith.
Well, given the growing public attacks on the faith of nominees, I fully expect the left will go after the nominee's religious beliefs. So the question is, how will Republican committee members and other members of the Senate respond? Well, let's find out. Joining us now is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, our good friend, Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Tony.
All right. This is going to be quite significant in what unfolds in the next few weeks. And I want to start let me just start this way. Let me ask you, if you have among those nominees that are being discussed, we have three appellate court judges that are being talked about, all three female. The president made very clear it'll be a female. We have Judge Lagoa, we have Judge Coney Barrett, and we have Judge Rushing that's been talked about. Do you have a preference of among those three?
I do. My preference among those three is Amy Coney Barrett. She's a distinguished jurist, lawyer, and legal academic. She serves currently on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and has for nearly 3 years. She was a law clerk to Justice Scalia, and she's a jurist who has been trained in the mold and would follow in the footsteps of great justices like her former boss, Justice Scalia, my former boss, Justice Alito, and Justice Clarence Thomas. That's exactly the kind of nominee President Trump has promised to nominate, and that's exactly the kind of justice we need on the U.S. Supreme Court, someone who will read the law based on what it says rather than on the basis of what some lobbyist or sociologist or psychologist might want the law to say, but in fact doesn't.
I would agree with you based upon my understanding of her track record. Now, this is a significant appointment to the court because, you know, going back to the Warren Court where we've seen this broad application of judicial preference in, judicial fiat in creating statutory acting as if they were creating statutory law. This would be the first time that we could possibly see a conservative, stable majority on the court.
It certainly could be, and what I prefer to think of there is a solid majority of people who are just willing to interpret the law based on what it says.
Right.
Now, if that makes it conservative, so be it. Whatever that is, that's what we want. We don't want our jurists making law. We don't want our jurists engaging in social engineering or taking hot-button political issues of the day that ought to be resolved in the political branches of government or by the states and decided by judicial fiat by a group of lawyers wearing black robes. That's not what we're interested in here. What we're interested in is restoring the proper balance of power between the federal government and the states and between the three branches of the federal government.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. In terms of conservative, when I think conservative, I think of Constitution, abiding by the Constitution, staying within the boundaries created by the founders. And that applies to the legislative branch and the executive branch as well, operating within the confines of the authority and power given to them. But you mentioned Amy Coney Barrett as a favorite. That sets up the conversation that I was having with Senator Graham quite well when I ask you this question about faith, because when she was confirmed for the appellate court, that was that memorable moment when Dianne Feinstein talked about the dogma within you speaks so loudly. I mean, that was a direct attack on her Catholic faith.
It was. It's a direct attack on her Catholic faith and on faith itself. It was utterly inappropriate. It's incompatible with the spirit, if not also the letter, of at least two provisions of the Constitution. The Article 6 ban on the application of religious tests, and not to mention the First Amendment. It's also just inappropriate and unnecessary. Perhaps most startlingly, Tony, it reveals the fact that there is something of an anti-religious sentiment that has come to pervade certain political offices in this country. We can't let that be legitimized. Our country was founded by people of faith and founded by people from a diverse array of religious faith traditions. We can't allow the left to demonize believing. What I took away from that hearing when she was attacked by one senator for having the dogma live strong within her and by another senator for questioning whether she was too orthodox a Catholic, it wasn't just that they were denigrating her for being Catholic. One of those senators was, in fact, Catholic. It was that they were denigrating her for believing too strongly in her religious beliefs. That is unacceptable.
It's frightening, quite frankly. It's frightening that that would be taking place in the United States Senate. Two questions for you, Senator Mike Lee. Do you anticipate that type of attack again on the nominee? And then secondly, how will Republicans respond to that if it happens?
I do anticipate that kind of attack, even though it shouldn't come. Even if I were just advising them for their own political interests, I would advise Democrats not to do that. Because if there's one thing that's going to solidify the American people behind this nominee, especially if it's Amy Barrett, it's that kind of ridiculous, bigoted attack. So it's the dumbest thing they could do on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm not sure they can restrain themselves.
Great.
Because the dogma of anti-religious sentiment, the dogma of religious bigotry, lives strong among today's ultra-left progressives. And so I'm not sure they can restrain themselves. And yes, to answer your other question, if they do that, We will respond with great passion. And I believe the authority of the overwhelming majority of the American people who will not tolerate that. I'm a religious minority myself, a religious minority whose ancestors were ordered exterminated by the governor of Missouri in 1838. I don't take kindly to seeing members of any faith bullied in this country. And I'm not going to stand for it here.
I agree with you, Senator. I don't think they can help themselves. I agree with you as well that politically it's not to their advantage to do this, because I do think this will be a galvanizing thing. I think much like, Texas, remember the Alamo, I think this will be remember the dogma. I think this will be a rallying cry for people of all Orthodox faith who believe there, who believe that there should be space in our society to exercise your religion freely in public and not have to check it at the door of public service.
Indeed it will. Indeed it will.
Well, Senator, we look forward to this process as it unfolds. I know you'll be front and center as a member of the committee. The chairman of the committee, Senator Graham, is saying that week of October 12th looks like we may be seeing hearings begin. So we're going to get right to it here pretty shortly.
Yes, I look forward to that. We'll be eagerly anticipating and preparing for the beginning of those hearings.
And you anticipate a vote on the Senate floor prior to the election?
Yes, it's imperative that we do so. I've been advocating to the White House and to my colleagues in the Senate that we need to do precisely that. We've got to get this nominee confirmed and confirmed before the election.
Very quickly, before we run out of time, the main reason that has to happen?
Well, the main reason is you never know what's going to happen in the wake of an election, especially in the middle of a global pandemic and an election season in which the Democrats have promised to continue to fight to contest everything at every moment and never give up. We're not in a position to, number one, need more time than we've got between now and the election. Number two, we're not in a position to be taking risks on whether we can get this done. We've got an obligation to do our job that our voters, those who elected us to office, expect us to carry out.
All right, Senator, I know you got to go vote. Go cast your vote. Thanks so much for taking time to join us today, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thank you so much.
Senator Mike Lee of Utah, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Look, he's been very, very good about this in terms of the religious freedom and the exercise of religious freedom and defending it. And I fully look for him to engage if whoever the nominee might be, if they're attacked over their faith. All right. Don't go away, folks. We've got lots more Washington Watch to come. I'm going to play some of the highlights from last night's Values Voter Summit, some of the conversations that we had. Dr. Al Mohler joins us next, or I'll be playing the interview we had with him late last night at the Values Voter Summit. Join us tonight, 8 p.m. 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Go to valuesvotersummit.org. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right on the other side of this break. Are you concerned with the state of our nation? And when looking at what's going on in our culture, do you wonder, what can I do? For the past 15 years, FRC Action has hosted Values Voter Summit, an event for people like you who want to shape the culture so that all human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. And this Values Voter Summit is going viral, so everyone can tune in and be encouraged to pray, to vote, and to stand in these significant times. Past speakers included President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Dr. Ben Carson, and Dana Lash. Register today for your free digital pass and join us virtually from September the 22nd to the 25th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Don't miss out. Remember, pray, vote, stand.
Since the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, Congress and many states have taken various actions to stop taxpayer dollars from funding abortions or the abortion industry. As early as 1976, Congressman Henry Hyde led the effort to ban federal funding for abortions. The Federal Hyde Amendment, named after him, established the principle that abortion is not health care, and therefore taxpayers should not be forced to fund abortions. Despite these efforts, the abortion industry still receives millions of dollars each year in taxpayer money. In 2019, Planned Parenthood, America's largest abortion provider, received $616.8 million in government funds. Family Research Council's newly updated pro-life map tracks how your state has taken action to stop taxpayer funding of abortions. Go to frc.org/pro-life maps to see where your state stands in the fight for life. That's frc.org/pro-life maps. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. Let me remind you once again, it is Values Voters Week. It's virtual, though, this year, so you can participate no matter where you might be. Go to valuesvotersummit.org, go to tonyperkins.com, whichever, and join us tonight. Great lineup of speakers again tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. In fact, I'll be sitting down with Dr. Ben Carson. You'll be able to hear that firsthand. Again, that's tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. All right, more violence last night, this time in Louisville, Kentucky, after police officers were not indicted in the death of Breonna Taylor. She was a 26-year-old woman fatally shot by Louisville police during a botched execution of a search warrant. Well, last night at the Values Voter Summit, Dr. Al Mohler, who was live from Louisville, joined us. Here's what he had to say. Let me just ask you this, Dr. Mohler, as we see these, it's like a repeat. We see these things happening again and again. As Christians, how should we respond to crises like these?
Well, Tony, what a great question. You know, we as Christians know that we are to seek righteousness and justice. Those are mandates given to us by God. But human beings, through the long course of human history, and Christians thinking about this seriously for 2 millennia, understand that justice comes by means of the rule of law, and it never comes by any other means. And the rule of law never achieves perfect justice. And in this life, we never actually will know perfect justice. Only God can execute perfect justice. But in the United States, what we have is a system of laws, not of men, as we often say. And that meant that today, for example, Attorney General Daniel Cameron here in Kentucky had to make a ruling according to the law as special prosecutor. And I think he set out that case just extremely well. We don't say that we live in a perfect world and there are no problems. We as Christians know better than that. But we understand that the rule of law is how these issues have to be addressed. And without respect for the rule of law, and without allowing the rule of law to move forward, then we doom ourselves to nothing more than whatever any group at any given time will call justice. We're not called merely to do what we think is right and call it justice. We're called to pursue justice.
Yeah, you and I spoke about this earlier. What you see as the most significant issues facing our nation as we move into this 2020 election. What are those issues that the Values voters should be watching, praying about, speaking to and standing up for.
You know, Tony, in the 2020 election, we face, in this context of this remarkable year, we face the fact that finally the mask is off, so to speak. The gloves are off. Now we find out that there are those who are calling for basically the undoing of the American experiment and replacing it with something else. We see those who are saying that the United States is, by its very existence, an unredeemable project. And the radical nature of frankly, what's being advocated by so many in the public square these days, it's final honesty after what we've known was that intention for a very long time. And so you see the subversion of the courts, and the courts turned into engines of social liberalism. You see how the school systems and higher academia have been basically taken over by what is rightly called the adversary culture. And we as Christians have to understand that now we're being told right out loud what we should have known, and that is that we're down to fundamental issues. And of course, the most fundamental of all is the sanctity of human life. And here we are in 2020, and the choice could not be more obvious. And it's a forced choice. Americans are either going to stand for the sanctity of human life, or they're going to subvert it, one or the other.
You know, when I look at what's happening on the streets, and Dr. Mueller, I mean, I know you look at it this way, but I look at this from a biblical worldview. So all these events that are occurring around us, we also consider the spiritual dynamics. I have to believe there is a relationship between the lawlessness, the looting, the unrest, and the fact that our churches have been shuttered for months now. Now, let me just say, I supported the initial call for the churches, you know, to close just for, you know, the first 2 weeks, then it turned into a month to slow the spread. But we're now going on 6 months. At what point should the churches be looking at this and questioning the motives of government and their mandate from God?
You know, Tony, another really good question. I think what we see is the fact that some politicians have taken this COVID as an opportunity for overt hostility to religious congregations and especially to Christian churches. And that overt hostility is what we have to confront. No government authority has a right to say that church isn't essential. No government authority has the right to tell us how we are to order our worship services. And no government has the authority to say that Christian churches or other religious gatherings can be uniquely discriminated against. Where there are reasonable, temporary, generally applicable rules, well, I think we'll all understand that, you know, but that's not what we're looking at in some cases. In D.C. with Mayor Bowser and in California with Governor Newsom, we're looking at unrealistic, unconstitutional, opportunistic, and overtly hostile actions. And at that stage, we have to confront. And we need to be clear. I don't think we should be saying that we want to escape and have an escape clause from the rightful orders that are given to people in the society out of concern for health. That we respect zoning laws, even though, or we contest them in court. We respect what the fire marshal says is the limitation of how many people can sit in a room. But it better not be different for a Christian church than it is for the local high school and its auditorium. It better not be any different for a casino, as we have seen in the state of Nevada unconstitutionally, than for a Christian church. And I think what we're seeing right now is a political opportunism that is actually overt hostility. And we've got to confront that.
Dr. Al Mueller, thanks so much for joining us at the Values Voter Summit. Always great to talk with you, my friend.
And with you, Tony. Thank you so much. God bless you all.
All right, when we come back from the break, we'll be hearing from Dave Hoppe. He'll be giving us a historical perspective on filling Supreme Court vacancies. And by the way, the whole focus of this year's Values Voter Summit, America, pray, vote, and stand. And I want to encourage you to take the challenge. You can text me the number 53445, 53445, the word vote. And you can take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. Again, that number 53445. Text the word vote, and you'll take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right on the other side of this break.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
As churches consider gathering again, they should develop plans to reopen and operate according to the guidance of the CDC, along with state and local guidance that does not violate the First Amendment and other religious freedom protections. Family Research Council has a helpful resource with best practices and tips for churches and places of worship to consider when crafting their reopening plans. Romans 13 instructs Christians to be subject to the governing authorities. The civil authorities have a difficult task ahead, and we should seek to be a part of the solution through cooperation and service to our communities. Some states and authorities like Nevada and California are treating religious entities more restrictively than non-religious entities. But as long as restrictions are temporary, applied equally to religious and non-religious gatherings alike, and there is a good reason for putting them in place, government restrictions are not likely to violate religious freedom protections. To learn more and to view this resource, visit frc.org/churchguidelines.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, tonyperkins.com. It is Values Voter Week. Every night this week, the remainder of the week, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, you can tune in for free. Go to valuesvotersummit.org and sign up tonight. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Ben Carson, one of our featured guests, will be joining us. Also, we'll be hearing from Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma. Now, did you take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand? You could take it by texting the word VOTE to 53445. 53445, the word VOTE. Over the next several weeks, we're going to hear a lot about the Supreme Court and whether or not it should be filled or has it been filled before and is this new. Well, Dave Hoppe, who is a longtime staffer on the Hill, served in several leadership positions, including former chief of staff for Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. He explains the historical precedent for what the Senate has done when the president nominates someone to the Supreme Court in an election year. He joined us at the Values Voter Summit, and here is what he had to say. Dave, welcome to the Value Voter Summit.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, Tony.
Now, let's start with the very basics and kind of walk the Value Voters through this. What power does the Constitution give to the president, and what power does the Constitution give to the Senate?
It's really very simple and very straightforward. It's just done in a couple of words. In Article 2, the president is given the power to nominate justices for the Supreme Court. And in Article 1, the Senate is given the power to advise and consent on those nominees. It's just as simple as that and just those words. In the history of our country, this is the 58th fourth year of a presidency. In some cases, George Washington had 2 fourth years of a presidency. In some cases, they had only 1 fourth year of a presidency, but there have been 58 of them. 29 times, half of the time, statistically, half of the times in that fourth year of a presidency, there's been a nomination for the Supreme Court. And every time it has happened, the sitting president has nominated somebody. Mm-hmm. And if you look, what happened then was if the president and the Senate were of the same party, that person was acted on. 17 out of 19 times, that person was confirmed. If the president was of a different party than the majority control of the Senate, then for the most part, it wasn't acted on. 2 out of 10 times was it acted on in that case. This is not wildly something that's wildly strange. It happens half the time.
Well, the media has apparently doesn't have any history books. But let me. I was reading the paper today, and you know they were talking about the hypocrisy of the Republicans, and it went down all of the lists of Republicans who have gone on record saying they will vote to confirm or they will vote to move forward. They're ready to move forward. They haven't said how they're going to vote because they haven't seen the candidate yet, but they said they will move forward. And then they compare that to what happened, as you just made reference to, that Barack Obama in his final days was able to make a nomination of Mr. Garland. Mm-hmm. But the Senate was in control of the Republicans. And so they're trying to compare, in my view, it's apples to oranges.
It is completely apples to oranges. And once again, look at the statistics. And the statistics are very clear, and it happened both parties, both ways, all the time. If the president is of the same party as the party that controls the Senate, that person gets a vote almost all the time. If it's not, they don't get a vote. And this is anybody who argues that the Democrats would be doing anything different right now. Just go look at all the Democratic quotes from 2016. Had to have a vote, had to have a vote, had to have a vote on Merrick Garland. That's fine. They were making that argument. The problem was they had lost the Senate.
So, Dave Hoppe, let me ask you this. Can the Democrats hold up this nomination?
They can try, and there are some things they're going to be doing. I don't think they'll be able to hold it up ultimately, but they're going to try everything in their power. You've seen them talk about, sort of the obvious things. If we get in power after these elections, we're going to get rid of the legislative filibuster right in the Senate, and we're going to have two new states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, and we're going to pack the court with judges. Those are all things they've already said. The new part of this conversation is that Speaker Pelosi decided that she might just apparently provide impeachment after impeachment vote on the House floor. And, of course, the Democrats in the House will have to vote for those impeachments or they won't get money from their party to run for reelection. So they will all be forced into it. Can they send them over? They can send them over lock, stock, and barrel. But at some point, the control of the Senate is under the control of Senator McConnell, and he has been very clear. We are going to move forward, and there is time to do it. Move forward before the election to have hearings, have a decision made on the floor of the Senate, and that can be done. And we'll see. I hope we won't, but I am very fearful that what we're going to see is an attack on whoever this nominee is that will be an attack on religion. I am afraid what we saw with Justice Kavanaugh, we will see even worse, whoever is nominated. And the heart of it is going to be freedom of religion, freedom to practice your religion. Yes, they'll talk about abortion, but freedom of religion and freedom to practice your religion in the public square is going to be very important and critical decision made here.
I think you're absolutely right. Dave Hoppe, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
I appreciate the work that you do. Appreciate the work of Judicial Crisis Network that's very active
yes.
on these issues of the court. And we're going to be covering this every night for the next 3 nights. So I hope you'll tune in each night for our panel on judges and the Supreme Court. That was my interview with Dave Hoppe regarding the Supreme Court, that panel sponsored by the Judicial Crisis Network. And there's more to come tonight. We'll have another panel on the Supreme Court answering your questions. So join us 8 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. Go to valuesvotersummit.org, tonyperkins.com, whichever. Follow it over. Join us tonight at 8 p.m. All right, don't go away. When we come back, I'm going to share with you an interview I had on Capitol Hill. Sit down on Capitol Hill, at the Capitol, with Congresswoman Ann Wagner, the author of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, and the minority whip, Steve Scalise, who's helping her try to protect those babies who are born alive, who survive an abortion, to get medical care, life-saving medical care. That's next. Don't go away. Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increasing pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/human-sexuality.
The history of the United States is preserved in archives, books, and the collective memory of the American people. It is also preserved through monuments and memorials that visually represent the extraordinary history of our nation. To tell these stories and remind ourselves of the importance of these memorials, Family Research Council has a new blog series highlighting the most recognizable and popular monuments in our nation's capital. This series devotes particular attention to the historical and spiritual themes depicted in each monument, sharing some not-so-well-known facts about their history, design, and symbolic meaning that shed light on our nation's deep religious heritage. This series aims to inspire the next generation to see the importance of these monuments and to remind us of the virtues and lessons that they memorialize. To read FRC's Monument Series, visit frcblog.org/monuments. Again, that's frcblog.org/monuments.
This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins, and it is Values Voter Week. That's right. Every night this week, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Values voters from across the country are gathering together to hear from some of our nation's key leaders. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, tonight we'll hear from Dr. Ben Carson. We'll hear from Senator James Lankford. We will hear from Dr. Bill Bennett, and the list goes on. Check it out. Go to valuesvotersummit.org to see who will be joining us tonight, and I hope you will be. It's free. You can join from wherever you are. Go to valuesvotersummit.org. All right. I also, last night, played an interview where I sat down on Capitol Hill at the Capitol with Missouri Congresswoman Ann Wagner and the Republican whip, Steve Scalise, to discuss an important piece of legislation that has been stalled by Democrats. It is the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. What this simply does, it says if a baby survives an attempted abortion, that life-saving medical care must be given to them. But yet, as you'll hear in this interview, that's been blocked over and over. Here's the interview with Ann Wagner and Steve Scalise. Ann Wagner, I'm going to start with you because you are the author of a bill that has gotten a lot of attention. It is the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. And if I were to look for something that drew a contrast between the two competing ideologies here in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill, it would be this issue.
It would be. And you would think this would be a bipartisan issue, making sure that we provide medical care to a child that is born alive as a result of a botched abortion. It's unconscionable. It grieves me to think that both sides of the aisle can't come together on an issue like this. But the fact of the matter is that Speaker Pelosi has held this up time and time again. I introduced this legislation very proudly in February, and shortly thereafter, the whip put forward his discharge petition. But this is something that did pass in prior Congresses in the U.S. House. And all that we're asking is that you provide medical support for a child that is born alive.
This is quite amazing, Steve. You know, we go back to the Louisiana legislature, Louisiana being one of the most conservative in terms of the life issue states in America, and you've teamed up with Ann to try to get a vote on this. Now, you have a discharge petition, and you're up to
205 signatures now.
205. You have to have 218, but you've also gone to the floor 80 times for a request that they at least be an up or down vote on this.
Right. You know, and this is, we're the people's house. We're supposed to be this deliberative body where we debate issues that the public is concerned about. When you think about this idea that a few states have already indoctrinated, New York being the most prominent, you heard the governor of Virginia talking about allowing a baby to be murdered after it's born alive and then call that abortion. To me, that's murder. I don't understand why you would need a law to protect it. But then when you look at the fact that in some of these states, they're allowing it, it's legal in states like New York to murder the baby after it's born alive. This is an area where everybody, as Ann said, should be able to come together. Republicans, Democrats, people that are pro-choice think that it's wrong to murder the baby after it's born alive. And yet Speaker Pelosi refuses over and over again to bring this bill to the floor. I think she's scared to death of this kind of debate. First of all, just most people, when you tell them that this is legal, they're shocked that you can actually do this to a baby that's born alive. You can literally murder that baby. So it's something that I think ought to be front and center as we approach an election where so much is at stake. This is one of those dividing points because we've got 205 signatures. This, by the way, got the most signatures of any discharge petition in the history of Congress on the first day. Broke 100 signatures on day one. Never happened before, which tells you this is something people really care about. But Speaker Pelosi is threatening members on her side that sign it. In fact, the first Democrat that signed it, Dan Lipinski of Illinois, represents parts of Chicago, a union liberal who's pro-life. AOC and the far left ran somebody against him in his primary after he signed this discharge petition, and they beat him. They defeated him in his Democrat primary in part because he's pro-life. So their party is no longer the party that works with us on life issues. They are not only pro-abortion, they're for murdering babies after they're born.
Right. I think Dan Lipinski was the last pro-life Democrat, solidly pro-life. And we have a few that may be marginal. But when I got here a little bit before you did, Steve, when I got here 17 years ago, there was about 40 pro-life Democrats.
It used to be a uniting issue, like Ann said. We all stood up for life. And there was a strong majority. It wasn't even marginal. Today, because of Speaker Pelosi's resistance to even a debate on this, you really have no Democrats that are willing to stand up for life.
Really, this isn't really an abortion issue. This is an infanticide issue.
It is. It is an infanticide issue. And the reason that it needs to be taken up federally is that currently there are 24 states that do not, they lack the kinds of protections for these infants that are born alive. And we're just asking that this child, this precious child, be given the same kind of medical support and assistance that any child that may be born prematurely or otherwise would receive. Instead, they're discarded. They're left to die. This piece of legislation would also mandate that the states keep and report data so we can get more accurate figures on this. We held a hearing back in September on this issue and brought in survivors of botched abortions that were left to die but saved by maybe that ICU nurse that came in and said, no, I won't let this happen. We had OBGYNs. We had people who used to be pro-abortion who have changed their views because of these very practices. But to think now that we can't even bring this to the floor after 80 times, this Congress stood up and the Republicans said, please, judiciary, let this be discharged. Let us vote up or down on this.
Yeah, and the science is on our side. They want to deny science. So many doctors, as Ann said, have talked about how abhorrent this process is, how it should not be legal, it shouldn't be allowed. And for Democrats who try to say this doesn't happen, we were able to bring some of those survivors of abortion. You want to talk about people, special heroes, people that are alive and have a purpose. Someone who survived an abortion and they're willing to tell their story, and it's a passionate story over and over again. We need to fight for them. So many, and obviously the values voters have been at the forefront of fighting for the least fortunate, the people who don't have the voice that everyone else has, and that's what we need to continue to fight for.
Well, that reporting component of this bill is extremely important because when you look at what's happening across the country, it's not being reported. Just, I think it's about six states that report.
Six states that are reporting currently. So, but the information is there. And I know you've interviewed many of the survivors. And Melissa Oden, who comes from my own state of Missouri.
Great spokeswoman. And she tells the story. But also Abby Johnson, former Planned Parenthood clinic manager, says this happens a lot more than you would want to admit. This is a frequent occurrence where a child is born alive.
Yeah, and it's an issue where we really ought to get a resolution on it. We ought to have this debate on the floor. I think Speaker Pelosi doesn't want to bring it to the floor in part because she knows it will pass, because who's going to go back home and explain how they voted against it? Yet some people are hiding behind the veil of Speaker Pelosi so that they don't have to be heard on this. They can sign that petition. 15 Democrats signed the discharge petition, and it's on the floor being debated with an actual vote. And yet so many of those Democrats who ran saying they were pro-life. And again, I mean, if you run, be who you are. But if you say you're pro-life, you have to sign this discharge petition. Otherwise, you're not really pro-life if you're not willing to stand up for a baby born alive outside the womb.
I think this is really the day of black and white. You can see so clearly the distinction between the two. There's very little middle ground on these core issues. And so kind of wrapping up our time together, the Republicans have put forth a commitment to America, basically stating what you're for, what you're going to work toward if the American people were to give you the majority again. What are the highlights there?
The real foundations are, first of all, renewing that commitment to America, to go back to those principles that made this country great. We've got to rebuild this country. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Clearly, we need to get through this. We're on the verge, by the way, of a vaccine for the first time in the history of our country to be just months, not even a year into a virus that this country and this world had never seen, to where we have three different drugs that are showing incredible promise in the final stage of FDA testing. And you could actually have multiple vaccines within a few weeks. That's unprecedented. President Trump's leadership through Operation Warp Speed, getting rid of red tape, not cutting any corners, but just saying this is going to be the focus of our country. The best, smartest scientists in the world are working on this and getting tremendous growth and progress. And so we need to get our country back on track. We need to reopen our schools, for goodness sake. If there's never been a better argument for school choice, you have some school systems that are taking your money but won't safely educate your child when a school system down the street has shown how you can safely educate the child. Why shouldn't the parent be able to choose where their kids go if somebody's not going to safely educate your child? It's hurting those children. So you see it all right now in front of us. Will we get our economy back on track? We had built the greatest economy, maybe in the history of the world, working with President Trump before. We can rebuild it again, and we have to rebuild that great economy again, fighting for families, fighting to restore our way of life. That's really what this is all about.
And Tony, this is about safety and security, both the safety and security of our health and our families, the safety and security of our economy and jobs and growth, and also, I think, the safety and security of our own persons. And part of the safety and security means sticking up and standing firm for our culture of life. Again, giving that voice to the voiceless. It is about freedom. It's about restoring our freedoms that are very basic to who we are, but it's about security, safety, security in every way, shape, or form. And I can't imagine anything more important than securing the life of our unborn children and those that are, in fact, even born alive.
Yeah, we need to defend life. We need to defend all of our rights right now because, look, the Second Amendment is on the line, too. We're not only fighting for life, we're fighting for, as Ann said, the safety and security of our communities. Who would have thought there would be a debate going on in this country whether or not we would support or defund police? I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the bravery and heroism of police officers who fight, defend our lives, defend our communities every single day, and they put their lives on the line. If there's a dirty cop, we all support getting rid of that cop. But by and large, the vast majority of our police officers are risking their lives, and they have a right to go home to their families every night, too. This idea that you would take away that basic support mechanism and defund them and make these communities less safe, it's a dangerous concept that actually is gaining some steam, and some cities have done it to the detriment of the people in those communities. So who would have thought we'd be in this debate? But we're in it. And that means we have to fight for those basic principles that not only that make this country great, but that keep our communities safe. That's what's on the line this November.
Final question for you, and you see this firsthand. Most conservatives wanted to, as you've described, Dan, want to take care of their families. They want to live in peace. But we live in this cancel culture where the values that we care about, if you stand up and speak about them, you are viciously attacked. What do the conservative voters out there in America need to do to ensure that we preserve this republic?
You want to start? Well, a lot of it begins, I think, in the educational process, which begins in the home. The best place to educate and teach our children the values that we share and espouse come from the kitchen table and come from our families. They come from our faith and our faith communities. They come from our educational community, which is really its struggle right now. When you lose the press, when you lose the education, you lose your freedom. So it is up to our families to restore these kinds of values. And I think that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for their freedom to be able to stand up and espouse the values that they believe in for themselves, their families, and their communities.
And look, we know values voters understand this, but we can never overstate it enough. The most important thing you can do is vote. Because when you see people coming and trying to take away the values and the principles that make this country great, the very rights and freedoms that make America the most unique country in the world that fights for freedom every day, if you don't vote, they will outvote you and take that away. They've made it clear they're willing to do this. And we know what we stand for. We're not afraid to say it. The folks on the other side that are saying things implicitly that tell you that they will take those rights and freedoms away, if we don't vote and they do, those rights and freedoms can go away. As Ronald Reagan said, freedom's only one generation away from extinction. We will not let it go extinct on our watch, but that means we have to vote. We know what's at stake. They're saying it directly and indirectly. We know what we stand for. Cancel culture is a dangerous concept. Maybe in totalitarian, communist, and socialist regimes, they shut down opposition. We're supposed to embrace it as conservatives or liberals. Our colleges and universities really need to step up and turn away from this. And President Trump's actually been very aggressive at saying you're going to lose federal funding. That's right. If you turn away people's viewpoints, if you discriminate against people based on their political views, of all places, college campuses shouldn't do it. But we're seeing that, and that's where we need to stand up against it. So where you see it, stand up and be vocal, but vote. That's the most important thing.
Congressman Steve Scalise, Congresswoman Ann Wagner, thanks so much for sitting down with us and for joining this year's Values Voter Summit. And thank you for standing up for the value voters here on Capitol Hill.
Well, God bless you. God bless this great country, Tony.
Amen.
Again, that was my interview from last night's Values Voter Summit with Ann Wagner of Missouri and Steve Scalise of my home state of Louisiana. Tonight, another great lineup of speakers. You can be a part of it. Go to valuesvotersummit.org to register. Join us at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, as I mentioned, Dr. Ben Carson, one of our featured guests tonight, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, and many, many more. All right, folks, until next time, I leave you with this, the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.